much. So we're on the bottom of page 6 in the supplementary source sheets. We're on page 100, Siman Yud Beis, in the Hadarom printout, in the Simanim from Schwartz's Sefer Halichos Regish, having to do with Eben Ezer. I think it may have been announced from the Pope Leticins that somebody was dedicating this shiur in someone's memory, and I don't remember whom, but if so, then certainly it should be. Sam Zelensky, okay, so it this should be the Eloi Nishmas Sam Zelensky's mother. And I'd also like to mention, in addition, that this shiur should also be in the schus of Mr. Rabbi Shael Bellows, who was nifter and used to be a regular attendee, member of our chabura, really added a lot through his presence and through his support over the years of this shiur, and his very positive and helpful comments that he made to me, and he really kind of reinforced my own energy to give this year by the enthusiasm that he brought into attending this year. So I really owe him a tremendous debt of gratitude. Yisachro Baruch. So Rav Schwartz is an interesting tshuva that I actually got some feedback about. This has to do with whether you would say Sheva Brachos for all 7 days. The Ish Garush, for a man who is divorced, Hanosa Gioris Pesula, who marries a woman who's a Gioris, but she's a Gioris who is a Pesula. She's a virgin. She had not been married. She didn't have relations before she converted to Judaism. So normally, if a man marries a Pesula, even if the man had been previously married, but he marries a Pesula, so then there is a full Sheva Brachos. Obviously, there's always a Sheva Brachos at the wedding itself, at the chuppah itself. But there's a full 7 days of Sheva Brachos in such a case. And the question is, if a man was previously married, and then he got married to a woman who herself was previously married, so we know then that we don't have Sheva Brachos. Then it's only one day. And this is all spelled out in a sugya in Ksuvas on Daf Zayin, going from Daf Zayinim and Aleph to Zayinim and Beis. You look at the top of page 7 of those supplementary sheets. So, Amar Abba Bazav, the Marab, Achas Pesula, Achas Amana, Tuna Bracha. That it doesn't matter whether a woman is a Pesula, she's never had relations, or she's an Amana, she was a widow who had relations, she requires a Bracha. It sounds like she requires Sheva Bracha. So the Gemara says, oh, but didn't Rav Huna say that Almana ain't a tuna bracha, that if she's a widow, that she doesn't get Sheva Brachos? So we say, well, it depends. That there are Sheva Brachos, meaning 7 days of Sheva Brachos, if we're dealing with Kan B'Bracha Shinas Almana, if for the man who's getting married, the Chasun, it's the first time that he's getting married. He was never married before. We don't really reckon so much when it comes to a man, whether he had relations, not relations, it doesn't change him physically. So the question is simply, was he previously married or not previously married? If he's a bacha, it means he wasn't previously married. So even if he marries an amana, this is the halacha, that there are 7 days of sheva bachos, despite the fact that she was previously married. Can't be amon shenas amana. But when is it that we say that we don't have 7 days of sheva bachos? That's when you have a man who was previously married who marries a woman who was previously married. So the Gemara didn't really have that understanding that we're talking about 7 days at this point in some sort of time, so it asked the Kasha. It says, is it true that an Amon that marries an Amona, man previously married, marries a woman who was previously married, that lo, that there wouldn't be Sheva Brachos? But we learn the whole inyan of Sheva Brachos from whom? From Boaz. When Boaz married Rus, and Boaz had, was Ipsan, he was previously married, and Rus was married to Machlon, right, it says, and they brought 10 men together so that they could say Birchas Chasanim. That's what they blessed. That's why they had 10 men, so that they could say Birchas Chasanim. And Boaz was, in fact, this a paradigm of an Amon who marries an Amon. So the Gemara explains, no. When Rav Huna says that when an alma marries an amana, a man who was previously married marries a woman who was previously married, there are no sheva brachos, that means the inatuna bracha called Zion. That means that there aren't 7 days of sheva brachos, but there would be 1 day of sheva brachos. So in that case, Boaz and Ruth, so certainly they made a berachas chasanim at the time of the chuppah when they got married at the party, at the end of the reception, but beyond that, there wouldn't be sheva brachos for a full 7 day period. So Tosfos, I'm sorry, yes, question.
Yeah, is it prohibited to have sheva brachos? Like if they want to, of course, you know, one of them's from another city and they want to have it for people who couldn't attend the wedding.
You can have parties, but it would be considered to be a bracha levatala. It would be a bracha levatala if it's not warranted according to the halakha in terms of the simcha, the excitement of the occasion. So then it would be a bracha levatala if you made the sheva brachos for the entire 7 day period. So Tosfos asks a question which really is the foundation of this tshuva that we have to some degree, which is it true that that Rus was really an almana? Remember, Rus converted to Judaism, and we have the whole story of her converting to Judaism when she had the conversation with Naomi, that she was saying, I'm going to accept your mitzvos and I'll join your nation and accept your God. That whole conversion process, which we derive according to the Gemara in Yevamos from the conversation between Rus and Naomi, only took place after Machlon died. She was a Nachris. Seems like it was an intermarriage of sorts. Of course, that's a major discussion amongst the various posts. It wasn't an intermarriage. Maybe it was a geirus, but it wasn't such a good geirus. It was a questionable geirus. It was a geirus that was without kabbal so mitzvos, and it only it became valid the mafreya retroactively, like the Rogachev Gaon claims. But those are chidushim. The simple pshat, as Tosfos says, is that she was a nachris. She wasn't Jewish, and then she only converted afterwards. So lav davka amana, the kshinistis the machlon haisa nachris. She was a nachris. So what do we see from here, says Tosfos? That even somebody who's not an amana, she wasn't previously married. What it means is that the fact that she had relations, because she was married to Machlon when she was not Jewish, and she had relations with Machlon, presumably, so therefore she wasn't a besula. So the fact that, number one, she wasn't a besula, and Boaz wasn't getting married for the first time, that's why he wouldn't have Sheva Brachos for 7 days. So, therefore, she would be considered to be like an almana for these purposes. So the Chiddush of Tosfos is that if somebody is a bu'ula, so then they would not be subject, a woman who is a bu'ula would not be subject to sheva brachos if she's going to marry a man who was previously married. What if the man was not previously married? What if he lived together with a woman? You have a man living together with a woman in sin. They're living together, you know, having premarital relations, and now they decide that they're going to get married. They're not so frum when it comes to this particular inyan, unfortunately. Now they want to get married, so do we say, are there sheva brachos? Do we have 7 days of sheva brachos? They were already living with each other. Or do we say not? So the Chasam Sofer has a famous Kiddush, and this is quoted in the Piskei Tshuva, in Evan Ezra Simon Samach Bey, Sifkaton Tess, where the Chasam Sofer says that there are two separate reasons why you might have 7 days of sheva brachos. Mm-hmm. One reason to have 7 days of sheva brachos is if it would be if you would have a besula who gets married. If you have a besula that gets married, so then we have what's called the chiba of the bia. It's a bia chadasha. This woman has never had relations before, and even though the man who might be marrying her was previously married himself, but this is the first time that she's having bia, the first time she's having intimate relations. So therefore, that's a simcha, at least the 7 days of sheva brachos. But then he says, there's also the chiba of nisuin chadashim, the idea that somebody's getting married for the first time. So even if the woman herself had bia previously, even if she had bia with this very same man previously, if he was never married before, this man was never married before, so then there's the chiba, the excitement that he's getting married for the first time, and from his end, if he's getting married for the first time, that would be a reason to have 7 days of sheva brachos, and therefore, even when the couple lived together, since they didn't live together as husband and wife, and only now is the man getting married for the first time, despite the fact that there's no great excitement that he's going to have intimacy with this woman for the first time, he already had intimacy with her, but he's having nisuin for the first time, so therefore, there would be sheva brachos for that reason. So then the question becomes, but what if I have a man who is a garish, he is a divorced man, he was previously married, But he's now marrying a woman, whether she had relations with him or with somebody else, but she did have relations before. So then you don't have the chibas bia because she had relations with someone else before. You don't have the chibas nisuin from his perspective because of the fact that he was because he was married previously. So then you would not have sheva brachos in that particular occasion. So if a man married a giyoris, like Boaz was previously married, and he married a giyoris who had relations before she converted, so then you would have neither the chibas bia nor the chibas nisuin, and you would not have 7 days of sheva brachos. So the question that was posed to yes.
Will there be an argument that, you know, since one of the ways to do Mekadosh a woman is through Bia, that the man and the woman living together, they intend to be together, they had relations, that they're already married?
No, because they clearly did not intend to get married, you know, through a Bia at that point in time. But it wouldn't matter because it's true that Nodav Yehuda took the position that if they were living together without marriage, and now they're going to get married, he said nothing new is happening, and therefore you don't have 7 days of Sheva Brachos. But the Ksav Sofer disagreed with him anyway. So you don't have to come to that argument, because we basically, in the Ravadi Yosef is a long tshuva in which he demonstrates that we basically paskin like the Ksav Sofer. We all like the Ksav Sofer. So we don't have to say, oh, they had a mind to get married. It doesn't matter. Meaning that we hold, like, if you would say that, so maybe, you know, you'd have a belated Sheva Brachos or something. But here, they're clearly, you know, getting married at this point in time. This is the official marriage, and therefore, we're going to allow this man who's getting married for the first time to have a Sheva Brachos with this woman, even though he had relations with a woman. But the question is, we marry a Gioris, so clearly, if the Gioris previously had relations, so that's the Shita of Tosos. She previously had relations, and the man was previously married, so you don't have 7 days of Sheva Brachos. But do we presume that she previously had relations? We say that if a woman converts to Judaism, she's not allowed to marry a Kohen. And one of the reasons she can't marry a Kohen is because it's because she's considered to be a Zona. Why is she a Zona? So some say she's a Zona because there's a presumption that she must have had relations before she converted. But the truth is, we pass like Rav Shimon ben Yochai, we pass against Rav Shimon ben Yochai, I should say, that if the woman converts and she is less than 3 years old, then she couldn't have had relations with anybody. Nonetheless, she still is prohibited from marrying a Kohen. So we see that it's not necessarily dependent upon her having relations. It's because she comes from being not Jewish, that gives her the status of a Zona. Maybe it's a pasuk in the Divrei Kabbalah, that she wasn't born into the Jewish people, and that automatically disqualifies her from being a Kohen. So it seems that with respect to a Gioris, maybe there is sort of like a presumption, either there's a presumption that she had relations, or maybe she's prohibited even though she didn't have relations. But what do you do with a Gioris who clearly didn't have relations? She said she didn't have relations, and it's checked out with a doctor, if you could check such things out. And the doctor says, which presumably you can, says that this woman is still a besula, and she wants to have Sheva Brachos, despite the fact that she converted. So Rabbi Schwartz, interestingly enough, Paskin, she can't have 7 days of Sheva Brachos. She can't have 7 days of Sheva Brachos. Why is that? So Rabbi Schwartz focused, if you look at this Piskei Tshuva that we were reading at Source 7, so the Piskei Tshuva says that, let's say I have a case of a man who was previously married, and he marries an amana. She was a widow, but she was a widow because at the chuppah, you know, the husband said, "Arei mekudeshesli," it's all nice, and they said Sheva Brachos, and the husband is just like so moved and excited by the occasion that his heart just is running apace. He has a heart attack on the spot, and everybody sees that they never had relations because he just died right after the chuppah. So does this amana now, who didn't have relations, now she gets remarried, does she have Sheva Brachos? Does she have 7 days of Sheva Brachos? So it's very interesting. So he quotes over here from the Chasam Sofer, where he says that since she knows that she did not have relations, so she therefore is entitled to 7 days of Simcha, that the husband shouldn't go to work for 7 days, that's 7 days of Simcha. But in terms of 7 days of a Bracha, he says, Eich nivarech zayin brachos, how can you have Sheva Brachos v'yetzlenim b'cheskas b'ula? If we know that not everybody was at the wedding, or let's say, you know, that knows exactly the circumstances of when the husband died, maybe collapsed, he died later, whatever. Not everybody knows that there weren't relations. V'yetzlenim b'cheskas b'ula, filu eidim me'idim einem onim. That there are certain cases. I know that a woman went through with a marriage. She had the chuppah. She had yichud afterwards. Let's assume as well, in order for it to be like a full-fledged nisuin. So how do we know That she's not a be'ula. Certain women are considered to be a cheskas be'ula. They're considered to be in a status where the presumption is that they definitely had relations. So therefore, he says, and in this particular case, you would not have 7 days of Sheva Brachos. So says Rav Schwartz, he says that in our particular case, this is five lines before the bottom. He says go back another few lines. He says, Ayin Sham Bifnim Akshuva, the Shuva of the Chassam Sofer, if you have a woman that went to had a chuppah, but she didn't have relations, like Gabi Din Simcha Yesha Simcha Kozayin. When she gets married to the next man, she's entitled to Simcha Kozayin. Don't say Takanim for 7 days, fine. The Gabi Didashi Yodashi Lonibla Bahule, because she knows she didn't have relations. Shricha Pius Kozayin, so therefore the husband he's the first for her, she's the first time coming out of her state of being a Pesula, she needs special attention, he can't go to work for 7 days. Well, the Gabi Bracha, but as far as the Bracha is concerned, that's that. The Bracha is totally in all the people, all the Panim Kadoshas who show up. As far as they know, this woman was an Amona. This woman was previously married, so they assume she's a Bula. So Bididan, the Tali Bididan, Mekiman Shevslenu, the Gabi Didan, if you do Edom, 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 Nehmanim, Ayein Sham, even Edom, I'm a believer. So Imkain, the Pizeh, Benidon, Nidan, where there's no Chibas Nisuan Chadoshim, because this man is a Garish, she was married before and divorced. The Chemitam Chibas Bia, Yeshla Din Zona, she becheskas Bula. She's assumed to be a Bula if she was once a non-Jewish woman. And therefore, she was steeped in a world of promiscuity. So we assume that she had relations. So Schwartz doesn't distinguish between if she converted when she was 2 or converted when she was, 20. Or I don't know what happens if she converted when she was 7, when she's old enough to have Bia. But, I would assume that girls at the age of 7 are not presumed to necessarily have Bia, even the non-Jewish world. He says, Lo Shayak Levari Kozayim. He says, therefore, you wouldn't have a Sheva Brachos for the entire 7 days. Now what happens? But Moshe Feinstein doesn't have a tshuva specifically on this subject, but he is quoted in the Sefer Alei Yeshuvin by Rabbi Aaron Felder, who is the Abbezdin of the Bezdin of Philadelphia. So he talks about this particular case, and he says that with respect to when a widow and widower marry, Sheva Brachos is recited only at the first meal after the wedding, right, as well as under the chuppah, obviously, and you do not have 7 days. And the same law applies if a man remarries a divorced spouse, he's Maxeh Grishah, so he remarries the woman that he divorced, or both the bride and groom were divorced previously, right, or a divorced or widowed man marries a woman convert to Judaism. So Rav Moshe Feinstein basically paskins exactly like how do I know it's a Rav Moshe Feinstein? This is Rabbi Felder's Sefer. Of course, Rabbi Felder was a Talmud of Rav Moshe Feinstein, and he writes in a footnote, Kach Shemati Mimaran Shlita. I heard this from Rav Moshe Feinstein. This is not published by Rav Moshe Feinstein, but this is what he heard. Kabbalah from Rav Moshe Feinstein. If you look in the Yotzer Poskim, Yotzer Poskim quotes from the Chidah, the Chaim Shaul of the Chidah, who says that if a woman insists that she converted to Judaism, and she insists that she's really a besula, that she didn't have relations, and the man discovers taka that she's a besula, that's the case scenario that he gives, so then she is entitled to a full 7 days of Sheva Bracha. So Rav Moshe is against the Chidah, and Rav Aaron Felder points out that in the Sefer Sovas Machos, he also says, Kasu Shima Gioris od Besula, that if the Gioris is, he says, Ulam Besovas Samachos, despite the fact that Moshe Feinstein Paskins this way, in the Sefer Sovas Samachos, he writes, Shima Gioris od Besula Mebachim Sheva Brachos Kozayin Yomim, that if the Gioris is in fact a Besula, then you would have 7 days of Sheva Brachos. So I was contacted by a Rav in Budapest, Hungary, who got a hold of the Hadarom. So that was really, itself caused a great simcha that it's making its way around the world. So he's been reading Rav Schwartz's tshuvos, and he read this particular tshuva, and he was bothered by it. He says, why should it be the case? If we know for a fact that the woman maintains that she's a besula, and you can even check it out with a doctor and maintain that she's definite and confirm that she's definitely a besula. So he said, why should it be that you shouldn't get 7 days? So I said, Rav Schwartz is not alone. It's true, and this person actually, cited the Chaim Shaul, the Chidah, the opinion of the Chidah. The opinion of the Chidah was where we don't even know until after the marriage we've confirmed that she's a Besula. He says, Kal v'chomer, you have a doctor who checks her out, and we're able to confirm even before the marriage that she's a Besula, that she should be entitled to 7 days of Sheva Brachos. So I pointed out that Rav Schwartz, it does take a particularly harsh shita over here, but it's consistent with sort of this presumption that just like an Amana is always presumed to be a Be'ula, she's not objectively a Be'ula, that somehow Gioris, according to Rav Schwartz, is in exactly the same category, and that could be another way of understanding the Tosfos, except that in the case of the Tosfos, Tosfos was saying that Rusa was presumed to be a Beulah because she was actually married. She lived with Machlon for an extended period of time, not just because she was a Gioris. Mm-hmm. For that reason, she's assumed to be a Beulah, but that's how Rav Schwartz Paskin, it seems to be the way Rav Moshe Paskin. So it is a very strict opinion, and I have to say that clearly, as we see from the footnote in Rabbi Belder's Sefer, as we see from the Chidah quoted in the Yotzer HaPoskim, it's not Muskim. It's not Muskim L'Kol HaDeos. It is, on the other hand, Rav Schwartz is in good company with Rav Moshe Feinstein, but I would say in any particular case, one would have to really, you know, examine. It's funny because when I had a case, a different sort of case, Rav Schwartz kind of gave me a wink and a nod to be makel about a particular type of situation where the woman was clearly a Beulah, but exactly the opposite sort of situation, where it wasn't, where there would be a presumption that she was a Beulah. Rav Schwartz says, if the woman is a Gioris, presumably for sure she's a Gioris when she became older. She became a Gioris maybe at the age of 20 or something like that. Rav Schwartz doesn't say exactly what at what point in time the girl, the woman in question became a Gioris, but it seems that we're not talking about a woman who converted at the age of 2, because then obviously she would be a Besulah. But this is the case, but Rav Schwartz is saying, if the person is a Gioris, it's like a woman is an Almana, there's a presumption that she's a Beulah, it doesn't matter what she says, that we have to look at the crowd that has assembled. The crowd that has assembled will assume that this woman is a Beulah. It's not appropriate to say she have a Bachos, fine, at least for the full 7-day period. But what if you have a woman who wasn't married? She wasn't married, but and therefore the presumption is that she is a Besula. Now she's marrying a divorced man. Marrying a divorced man. You're not going to say Sheva Brachos because of him, because there's no Chibas Nisuin. He was married once before. You'd only say Sheva Brachos because of her, because of Chibas Bia, because it's the first time that she's being intimate with anybody. The only thing is, she knows it's not true. She had relations with somebody. She's a Beulah. She's marrying this Garish. But from the perspective of most of the world, as far as the world is concerned, this Garish is marrying a woman who is a Besula, not a Beulah. And it'd be kind of embarrassing for her to say, oh, no, don't make Sherebach office me. But why not? It's the first time you're getting married. Well, I'm marrying a divorced man. Yeah, it doesn't marry, but it matters. It's the first time you're getting married. Well, there is a halacha that... you know, that would be kind of like very, very uncomfortable when people are planning the Sherebach office celebration. So... Maisa Shahaya, Kahaya, we did have such a Maisa.
What do you write in the Ksuba? Besulta?
Ramosha has a tshuva that if Ramosha has a tshuva that if the husband is willing to treat her like a Besula in terms of giving her the full amount of a Besula, he could write Besulta in the Ksuba. Some say you can write, you know, the Kalsa or something like that in the Ksuba, but you could say Besulta underneath the Chuppah so that the whole world doesn't need to know about it. So there are, you know, different ways. Or, as Rabbi Willard, you know, would say, you just quap at strategic moments, you know, under the Chuppah when you're reading the Ksuba. An interesting strategy. So, in this particular case, you had this Garush who was marrying a Balas Shuva, and it happened that she was a Bula. So,
Excuse me, Robert, isn't it by Gioris? Doesn't it say Giorta on the Ksuba?
It says Giorta, sure.
But it wouldn't be Giorta Besulta, then?
No, you wouldn't say it. You just say Giorta. You say Giorta Besulta.
No, I was going back to
it. It happens that if the girl converts before she's 3 years old, then she gets the full Messiah Zeus. She does get the full Messiah Zeus, even though you write Giorta, because she's clearly a Besula. But if she's older than 3 years old, the truth is it doesn't matter if she's a Besula. We always say Mea Zeus. It's a very interesting thing. So that's consistent with how Rav Schwartz Paskin. But take the opposite scenario, where there's an assumption that the woman would be a Besula, but she knows that she's a Beulah, and she's marrying a Garish. What do you do in that particular case? So that's the tshuva for an August. If you look on page 8, in source Hay, so this is exactly the tshuva that Rav Schwartz pointed out to me. So I had this case, and the couple wanted to know what to do, because it was really embarrassing for them. People were offering to make Sheva Brachos, and the woman knew that she was a Beulah, and there was a real question, should they agree to have Sheva Brachos or not? So Schwartz wouldn't give me an answer to say yes or no. He just said, oh, look at this tshuva by the Tshuva Zon Hogis. That's what he said. So it's a fascinating tshuva. So I opened up the tshuva, and the tshuva says, you have a Bachor Bachura, the Bali tshuva, they're coming to get married. Do they have 7 days of a Sheva Brachos? So he talks about a case where the man has not been married before, they were just living with each other, and now they both did tshuva and they're getting married, so then they would get Sheva Brachos, and he says, we pass them like the Ksam Sofer. All of that is perfectly fine. However, he says, however, when you have a situation where the woman is a Be'ula and the man had been married before, what do you do in that particular situation? So he says, look at the second line of the second paragraph of the tshuva. If he's a bachur, he's never been married before, no problem. We pass on Ksam Sofer. About garish, you know, say bechura beula. But if he's a garish, he's a divorced fellow. Now he's marrying a girl who was never married before, but she's a beula. According to Sam Sofer, since she's a beula, she only gets one day of sheva brachos. So he says, I had a case. It came in front of me. Remember that the shuas and agus of Moshe Sternbuch, before he became the head of the Yedah Haredis in Eretz Yisrael, he was a rabbi in South Africa, and he had like he dealt a lot with Bali Tshuva. That was the community that he dealt with over there. So he had to figure out, you know, how to help them. We need on Shabbat and I hear Zed Garish, Shikibi no Siba Sheva Brachos. And now they're having a big Sheva Brachos, and he's asking me to make the Bracha. I have no idea, like, how it even came to the Sheva Brachos, but apparently they had scheduled the Sheva Brachos, and Rosh Sternbach knew that the woman was a Bul, and he shows up to the Sheva Brachos, and now they're asking him to say a Sheva Bracha. I can't figure out the scenario. In the middle of the Sheva Brachos, they take him aside and say, oh, by the way, you should know, I don't know. And he says that I was terrified because I knew that Shnei Amudei Horah, both the Nodavi and the Chassam Sofer, both with the Osim Levarik Shiva, would say you can't make Sheva Brachos the entire 7 days in this situation. So what should you do? And the Aruch HaShulchan also says if she was Be'ula, she's treated like an Amana, that you can't say Sheva Brachos no matter what. So he says, and Misvara, look at the next paragraph. Amina Shakur Bagam Bulu Rakim Eforsim. So he says, maybe the problem is just when it's Eforsim, kind of like the flip side of a Schwartz. If the woman is a Gioris, so it's Eforsim, she's a Gioris, so it's assumed that she's a Bulu, according to a Schwartz. So he says, if the woman was never married, so then it's not Eforsim that she was ever Bulu. So therefore, Ukigon, how would it be Eforsim that the woman was Bulu if she was never married before? He has a great scenario. Ukigon, shotgun wedding. She's pregnant. She's walking down the aisle and she's pregnant. So then we kind of like know what's going on over here. But if she just like happened to have relations, nobody knows, and everybody's perfectly happy. So then he says, maybe dinam kashira b'shiva yomim. Maybe you can argue that that case is, well, the exact flip case. So from Schwartz, woman's definitely a b'ula, but she was never married before, so we don't know if she's b'ula. Maybe she should get 7 days of sheva brachos. So he said, this doesn't sound like a very Haredi psak, but he says that since I knew that if I would not make a bracha, it would be very embarrassing to the woman in front of everybody. Why is Rosh Sternbach not making a bracha? The gadol covered a bias aflitchos lo sasid v'barim, covered a bias is dolcha lo sasid v'barim. So he says that bracha v'atala according to Roposkim is only to Rabbanon. So therefore I decided that I'm going to override the Rabbanon of a bracha v'atala in order not to embarrass this woman. It doesn't sound,
if he knew all,
no, it doesn't sound like it is a carte blanche, you know, type of heter over here, that he said, I mean, he did give a svara. He said that maybe if it's not before some, it should be mutter, but at the end, he said that he really only relied upon covered abuse, which is not a reason to schedule the Sheva Brachos in the first place, you know, per se.
If he knew this about the couple, why did he even go to the Sheva
Brachos? Maybe it was Shalashudas or something, I don't know, maybe it was
Right. However, he says that then he brings from his mechutan, not his mechutan, I guess his son-in-law, Chasni and Muflag, Rav Hagaon, Rav Yisachar Shriver Shlita, that he says, if you look in the Bach says that the Sheva Brachos really is going on the Nisuin and not on the fact that it's a Bias Besula, in which case, if this is the first time that the woman is getting married, just like we would have Sheva Brachos if it's the first time the man is getting married, so maybe you should have Sheva Brachos the first time a woman is getting married, even if she should be a be'ula. And he says that, oh, what about the Tosfos in Ksuvos that seems to indicate that that you have a problem whenever you have a be'ula, because the Tosfos asks that Rus wasn't really married halachically to Machlon, so why couldn't you have Sheva Brachos for 7 days? It's because she was a be'ula on the Machlon. So he says, no, but she was a be'ula in the context of living in a marital situation. But if you had a woman who was never, even though it wasn't a halakhically valid marriage, but if you would have a woman who was never in a marital situation before, maybe you can argue, even in light of Tosfos, maybe you can argue, or even despite Tosfos, you can argue that you could still require, that it would still be appropriate to have Sheva Brachos. However, he says that this would only be in a situation where you can argue that it's not the Pirsum, that the woman was a be'ula, but if we're dealing with a couple, like a garush marries a balas tshuva, and they were living together, where clearly everyone knows that she's not a besula if they were living together, So then he says, you certainly wouldn't be able to be makel in that particular situation. So this is very, very interesting. So when this situation arose, I did speak, it was very shortly after I had arrived in Chicago, and I was, you know, dealing with this shaila, and I spoke to Rav Schwartz about it, and he says, well, there's the Chuas von Hugger, see what you can do. But then the other Rabbanim, who also found out about the situation, not because I told them, were very uncomfortable about it, you know, some of the other Rabbanim in the community. So in the end, I think they just ended up like leaving town after the wedding. So, but it's a very, you know, it's a difficult shiloh. But from Schwartz's vantage point, he was sort of comfortable with my being somech if it would be shayach to be somech if nobody else knew about it, to be somech on this Chuvas Ben Hugas potentially as sort of like the flip side of the equation. So it's kind of interesting because for him, it all depended upon what is the presumption in people's minds, in other words. While others would say, no, it all depends upon the reality. If you say it depends upon the reality, you'll be makel in the Giora situation, but you'll be machmir in the Beula situation. Even if nobody knows that she's a Beula, if she knows herself that she's a Beula, and she's marrying a Garish, then it wouldn't be appropriate to have the Sharon Bachas for 7 days. I think that is basically the minigolem. Okay, so we'll move on to the next tshuva. Next tshuva has to do with mistakes in Gittin. Ha ha, shkios mi oven. Shkios mi oven. It happens all the time. People make mistakes. The error is human. And we go over Gittin many, many, many times. But sometimes you discover a little bit of a mistake. What is a mistake that would be sufficient to passel a get? It's a very big deal to passel a get because sometimes a person's life, you know, hangs in the balance. You don't necessarily have a second shot, you know, to have another chance to do a get properly. It's a scary thing. So here is a get that arrived and there was a missing letter. There was a missing letter in the word towards the end of the get, usruchis. That towards the end of the get, it says, v'kadu patrus ushrakis usruchis, v'kado patrus ushrakis usruchis isichi lichi. It's all Aramaic, right? But it actually means something. What do the words mean? It means, and now, v'kado patris, I now do release, v'shavkis, and I discharge, usruchis, and I divorce, isichi lichi, you, okay? You are my wife. So this is basically the lashon. It's written in the first person. When a man writes a get, it's considered like he's writing, though even if he writes it with the hands of a sofer, it's considered like he's writing it himself, and it's written in the first person. And it says, I hereby, I now release, discharge, and divorce you. So what happens if there was, in this particular case, there was a letter that was left out of the word usruchis? Now, a get has two different parts to it. There's what we call the Torah for the get, and there's the tokus of the get. The Torah for the get is the main part of the get. If you make a mistake in the main part of the get, so then you could be in very, very serious trouble, even if you just get one letter wrong, then that is where you have the name of the man, the name of the woman, you know, you have the name Sipora, and you write Sipora, I don't know, that's pretty bad, because you have the wrong name in there, right? You have one letter that's missing, but it makes a big difference. Or the Makom HaZaman, you have the date, you know, you say Shiva Be'esrim Yom, and you wrote Shiva Yom, and you wrote Esrim Yom, and you left out the Shiva, pretty bad, right? Okay. If you left out the hey from Shiva, probably not so bad, if it doesn't change the meaning entirely. But it's considered to be much more consequential to leave out something from what we call the Torah, the main essence of the get, or gives the makom, the location, where the people are located. You know, are they in Chicago? In Chicago. Chicago might be a different city altogether, right? So, umakom areyat muteres l'chadam, or where it says that you are hereby free and permissible to anybody. So if you make a mistake in those various areas so of the get, so that's much more consequential. But if you make a mistake in any other part of the get that's not as consequential, we have double words, we have redundant language, we have belt and suspenders in the get, so you leave out one of those words entirely, it wouldn't possible to get. So if you left out the word usruchis entirely, it wouldn't possible to get, because you already said patrus ushavkis, I release and discharge you. So usruchis is just like another synonym. So it's really not so bad. If you left out the word entirely, it wouldn't be so bad. If it was the Torah, even if it was the Torah, if you left out a letter and it didn't change the meaning of the word, like you left out the hey of Shiva and you wrote Sheva, so that wouldn't also not possible to get. That's what the Shulchan Aruch says at source Aleph here in Simon Yud-Gimel, bottom of page 8. As long as we can recognize the general meaning and import in the pasuk b'shul dibug osachas, if you leave out one letter and it's not changing the meaning, so it's not going to pasuk even in the Torah of the get, it's not going to pasuk. Moshe Feinstein dealt with a case where it says in the get even the harayat muteris lechol adam, you're permissible to everybody, and it left out one word, harayat muteris adam, you are permissible man. Okay, so, I don't know, is that slang? Hey, you're permissible, man. Is that kosher if you left out the word l'chol? So, Moshe Feinstein says that if I'm only missing the letter of the shimush, the letter that, you know, sort of connects one word to the next word, so then that's basically okay. It brings a raya from a conversation that Siba had with David HaMelech in the early days of David HaMelech's reign. He was talking about Mephibosheth, you know, from the house of Shaul, and David asked, hey, where is Mephibosheth? And he says, oh, Hinehu Beis Machir. He's in house of Machir. What do you mean? He's house of Machir. He's house of Machir? I thought he's a human being. What do you mean? He's house of Machir. So he left out a base. He didn't say Hinehu Bib Beis Machir. He said Hinehu Beis Machir. So he said that, you know, if you're leaving out like the connecting word, it's considered as if everybody understands it's there. So if you said Harayat Muteris Adam, so it's understood Harayat Muteris Le Adam. It's understood that you're permissible to a person. Then the question is, oh, but maybe he only said you're permissible to a person. When a man divorces a wife, it has to be that she is muteris to kuliyama. She has to be muteris to the entire world, not just to one person. That's not going to be considered to be a valid yet. So then Rav Moshe says, yeah, but we find sometimes that one individual is considered like everybody. Like it says, the hadagah shir bayor mesa. The fish in the Nile River died. So it doesn't mean one fish died. All the fish died. Behema Rabba, you know, towards the end of Sefer Yoram. He's all the animals. So he says, even if you mention one, one can stand for everybody. So therefore he says, since technically you could say it was only the Os HaShimush, the Lamed, that was missing, and once you put the Lamed in there, then Le Adam means the Chol Adam, so you can fix that. So we go out of our way to fix, you know, situations. That's even, arguably, as the Ramban says, that's even in the Torah of the Get itself, Arayat Muteris the Chol Adam. Even though it says beforehand, a woman is permitted to get married to any man that she wants to get married to, but to getting married to any single man, because we have it says that you are permitted, Rashalim Hach Lisnasva the Chol Gorad Nitziyavien, you're permitted to marry anybody. We need Harayat Muteris the Chol Adam to teach you that a woman is also permitted to have znus with anybody. What do you mean? You know, I have to have znus? No. But you're not allowed to have znus for other reasons, but the gerushin doesn't prevent the woman from having znus. Meaning, while she was married, if she would have znus, so then she would be an eishesish, she would be adultery. But after marriage, she having znus is not adultery anymore. So therefore, Harayat Muteris Chol Adam allows for that possibility that she wouldn't be an eishesish having znus in the event that she would have znus. That she would engage in a promiscuous relationship outside of marriage. So we see the Wameka leaving in that case. So this was an easy shaila on some level for Rav Schwartz to say Yusruchis, which is really part of the topis of the get, where you don't need the word altogether. And he said that the letter that was missing didn't really change the meaning of the word here altogether, because it means the same thing even without the tuf. Now, he didn't say which tuf was missing. Now, remember, Usruchis has two tufs. If you left out the first tuf, I don't know what Uruchis means. I don't know what Uruchis means at all. So I assume that the tuf that was missing was the second tuf. And it was Usruchi. Usruchi, which still has the general import. Usruchi has the root of I'm driving out. The Suruch, I'm driving you out. So that he just was missing the last tuf. I even have a little footnote here in the tshuva, in the text. Kaniresh, Kavanusel, the Ost tuf, the Sofa Teva, Ha'aretz Ha'orech. So I got in there a little bit. So then he says that. So then they found, after the Mesiras HaGet, after the Get was delivered, they found this as the, you know, they're rereading the Get, because that's one of the things that you do after you give over a Get, the witnesses reread the Get, and only when they reread the Get did they find this problem, and now they're trying to figure out, you know, it's kind of like the Get, has it been signed and everything, the husband is gone, and is this Get going to be kosher? So he says that the person who wrote the Shaila to him was none other than the chief rabbi of St. Louis, Shalom Rifkin. And Shalom Rifkin himself thought that there was room to be Mako. So he says, well, Sark Mas Kavod Lidid Kavasi Bazer. You don't need me. You can be Mako completely on your own. So sometimes Schwartz would use the expression, Makbasi Ki Yehuda Ve'Odekla. What does it mean, Yehuda Ve'Odekla? There's a Gemara in Kiddushin that says that if you say to a woman that you are Charufasi, like Shifka Karufa, you are Charufasi, so that's, considered to be a term of endearment for marrying the woman. So, oh, really? I'd love to be your Charufasi. So Charufasi means, basically, I want to be betrothed to you. I want to marry you. And the reason is, because it says, V'hi shifcha necharefes li'ish, there's a pasuk in the Torah that indicates that this is a type of erusin, even though there it's talking about a shifcha, and you don't really have full-fledged marriage with a shifcha, but maybe it's talking about a chatzi shifcha, chatzi bas kohen. That's what the Gemara, has as an original supposition. But she came be Yehuda kohen arusa charufa. And also another reason is because in the area in the land of Yehuda, where the people from the tribe of Yehuda live, in that area of Eretz Yisrael, so they would call somebody who was an Arusa, who was betrothed, they would call her a Charufa. So then the Gemara says, "Yehuda be'olde kra." Why do I need with the custom that they had in Yehuda if I have a pasuk? Is it a pasuk good enough? Why do I need, you know, an additional, the fact that this was the minhag in Yehuda? So the answer, of course, is that Yishivka Nechavepes Lish might be talking about a Shivka Knainis who doesn't technically really have halakhic marriage, and that's why I need the fact that this was the minhag in Yehuda. But the original question, the Yehuda Ve'odekra, means, what do I need Yehuda for? So that's why Rav Schwartz would like to use that expression. He was very fond. You find in other Shuvas as well, he would say, Yehuda Ve'odekra, I'll be a Yehuda Ve'odekra. I'm going to give you like additional support. And he quotes from this halakha of the Shulchan Aruch, even in the Torah, if you're missing one letter and you could tell exactly what's going on, you're not going to passel the get. And I would just add, and here it was in the Tofis, it was in the less significant or consequential part of the get. So for sure, this was going to, this is going to be kosher. Okay, so that's all. We spent a lot of time on that, but just explaining sort of the basic guidelines. Simon Yudalad has to do with a few things. But the main part of the tshuva has to do with whether we're going to establish the writing of Gittin in a new city. What was the new city? The new city was none other than San Diego, California. That whenever there is a new location where you're writing a get, it's a very big deal. Very big deal, because you have to figure out exactly how you're going to write the name of the city. When they started writing Gittin in Lakewood a number of years ago, there was a big, you know, Tarai was a big a discussion and a big negotiation. Exactly how do you write, you know, the word wood? How many bubs do you put in? In the end, they did bub, bub, ala, bub, dalit, so they wouldn't have three bubs in a row, because you do use two bubs for the v sound, because only one bub would be like, you know, an oo, so you need two bubs for the v sound, and then you need a bub for the oo sound. So you do bub, 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 or you separate between the three bubs with an ala. So that's what you do, bub, bub, ala, bub. So that's as part of as Lakewood. What?
You said people get divorced in Lakewood?
Incredibly enough, so they did. So they had Lamed Yud Kuf above, above, Aleph above, Dalet for Lakewood, and then you had to figure out also every single city. There might be more than one Lakewood. There are more than one Lakewood. They Camp Morashah in Lake Como, Pennsylvania. Lake Como got changed to Lakewood, so they now call that Lakewood. So that's why, you know, the guys who go to Morashah Kolo, so Rabbi Mordechai Willig, who's the, you know, runs Morashah Kolo, says this is the real Lakewood, you know. So in Lakewood, so you also need to have Simanim to show which Lakewood it is, which rivers is it near, and stuff like that. Even here in Chicago, we have Simanim. We say, you know, Chicago, the Miskaya Chicago, two different ways of pronouncing it, neither of which are correct. Masa the Yasa al Cape Yama, the Miskaya Lake, Michigan. That this is the city that abuts the ocean, and it's an ocean that for some mysterious reason people call a lake. You know, so they say it's an ocean that's called Lake Michigan. But we have simanim, so you have to, so it's, and sometimes it's a big machlokas. What simanim do you have, what simanim should not have, and so forth. So they consulted with Rav Schwartz regarding exactly how they should write San Diego, because it became a more of a Jewish community in San Diego, and if you don't have Gittin written in a particular location, sometimes the residents are not going to travel to a far out place. They're not going to even travel to Los Angeles necessarily, and therefore some people who would otherwise have received Gittin are not going to get Gittin because they're not going to want to travel. So therefore, but you don't want to have Gittin in too many places, because maybe that will encourage too many people to get divorced. So therefore, no. So therefore, it is a very careful cheshbon every single time that you're going to establish a new place. Like here in Chicago, we were talking about, should we start to have Gittin maybe in the north suburbs somewhere, so that some of the Jews who are not as frum, and maybe if you made it more convenient for them to come into like their, you know, local temple or whatever, like even have a social hall up, a conservative temple, and write Gittin there. We were thinking of doing it in Northbrook. But Northbrook didn't really have an easy simon in terms of the river, because it's not right next to Lake Michigan. You have to go like through Highland Park or whatever to get to Lake Michigan. So I wasn't so keen about, you know, finding the right simanim, the right, because you really should have some sort of a water body. What?
Like, you should just use the state, because the state would make the city name unique.
No. But you need, but it's supposed to be rivers. That's always the minimum thing, that you're supposed to have bodies of water. But I'm saying, but these are important questions. So in San Diego, that was the question. So one question was, I'm sorry?
The ocean, yeah.
It's an ocean.
So San Diego, so you always try to have at least two simanim, if you can, right? So it clearly was right next to the ocean, because it's right next to the Pacific Ocean, right?
Yeah.
But there's also a major river there, which is called the San Diego River.
clever.
San Diego River. You know, it is very clever to actually use that term. So they answered the San Diego River. I don't know, like, who thought it was. So he says that the San Diego River is a very easy one because according to the map, because you take out maps, and this is what I've done, you know, when I, you know, had considered this question. I remember that we were thinking at one point in time, because there was a major problem in Muncie, New York. They right get to Muncie and Spring Valley. There was a river that they used as a simmer, but then the river dried up. And then there was a question about where in Spring Valley they could, you know, they would write, what's the incorporated village, what's not the incorporated village, and then what's considered Muncie and what's not considered to be Muncie. So you had a lot of questions, you know, with respect to writing Gittin and Muncie and in that entire area. So at one point in time, I was thinking that we would just expand it to the entire town, because Muncie and Spring Valley are both in the town of Ramapo. I grew up in the town of Ramapo, so I'm familiar with it. And I remember meeting with Rabbi Leibish Landesman a number of years ago, and he said, well, there are all these questions. Number one, most people, if you ask them where they live, they have no clue that they live in Ramapo. Nobody says, I live in Ramapo. He said, I live in Muncie, I live in Spring Valley. Number two, how are you going to spell Ramapo? Is it Ramapo with an I and Resha I and Mem Aleph, or Resha I and Mem I in, and you have a big machlokus about that. So everything, you know, it's not so simple to be kovea, you know, a shame for purposes of writing it. So he spoke about, what about San Diego River? So he pointed out, and he spoke about some of the letters from the local rabbis, that is there always water in the river or not? Why is this of a significance? Because sometimes you have rivers that dry up for a portion of the year. And he quotes from a tshuva of Rav Moshe, that if you have a river that dries up part of the year, but nobody ever actually walks inside of the river, it's only used as a river because there's like a bridge that you have to go over, and therefore, if there's even a bridge, so people say, oh, there's a river underneath the bridge, even if there isn't actually a river underneath the bridge. So he says that, you know, even in that case, we would refer to the river, despite the fact that there isn't always water in the river. And there's a Berhei tape that says that if most of the year there's water in the river, then you can use the name of the river. But he said, in the San Diego River, there's always water in the river. I don't know. I haven't really been to, anybody here been to San Diego? Okay, I think it's much better. So have you seen the San Diego River? Apparently there's always water in the San Diego River. So therefore he says that for sure that would make sense. But then there's another concern. The other concern is that there's a sheet of Chaim Cohn. It's in the Shilas of Chuas of Beno Chaim Cohn, who says that if you have a Jewish community that lives in a neighborhood and for a long period of time they never wrote Gittin in that particular vicinity. So he says there must be a good reason why they never wrote Gittin in that particular vicinity. Maybe there was a concern about, you know, whether you should use the name of one of the rivers or not, about maybe there's a river that, you know, that sometimes dries up, sometimes doesn't dry up. Maybe the Rabbanim were concerned that it's going to encourage a proliferation of divorce. So he says, so we don't intrude upon places where the Chachamim of yesteryear made a decision that for whatever reason they're not going to write Gittin in that particular city. However, you could do it b'shas hatchak, so you would have great Rabbanim like Rav Nachum Greenblatt, Zeka Tzadik Levracha, who was very close to Rav Schwartz, who would travel all over the country, and he would write emergency Gittin, and if it was a place where they never wrote a get before, so he said, oh, it's a shas hatchak, I have to do a get. So he would just make up a name, you know, he would make up how to write the name, and he would make up what the boundaries or what the signs were of the city, what rivers should be used as the simonim of the city, in order to be able to write a get, so that somebody should not be an aguna. That's a shas hatchak situation. But what about in terms of doing it on a regular basis? So Rav Schwartz makes the following very important observation. He says, look on the second page of the tshuva, on the second line, he says, Hineach ha-shosho sh'Rav Chaim Cohn l'shayich li'yos in Diego. He says that the concerns that Rav Chaim Cohn has do not apply to the city of San Diego. Because he said there were no old rabbis in the city of San Diego. There were no young rabbis. There were no rabbis. There were no Jews. There wasn't really a strong or significant Jewish community altogether. Maybe some here or there, some stragglers, but there wasn't a significant Jewish community in San Diego. It was not so big. And you certainly did not have many Orthodox Jews. That certainly has changed. So he says, now it's become a much bigger community. This was written in 1988, so how much more so when we fast forward to the present time? So he says, so for sure it makes much more sense nowadays that we should have Gittin there. So the assistant rabbi of Beth Jacob congregation, Rabbi Wittenberg, who is the assistant rabbi there, called me up after he got his Hadarom. He said, I really like this tshuva. You know, so because it validates kind of, you know, the strength and the significance and the growth of the San Diego Jewish community, that it actually made sense to start writing Gittin there. In Rav Mendelssohn Derovitz Sefer, of our, where Haaretz Le'Areha, where he writes about the names for different cities that are written for get purposes, and he writes about Chicago, and he writes about cities really all over America. So he does have, in his sefer, he has the San Diego, and he writes it exactly the same way that Rav Schwartz determined that it should be written. San Diego, Masad Yosef Kip Yom HaMahanar, San Diego. But it turns out that even before Rabbi Schwartz made this determination, that an old time rabbi who was sort of in a tough situation, in a Shasat Chak situation, had to write again in that particular fashion. And he said that he did it with a Haskamah of Natan Tzvi Greenblatt and with a Haskamah of Yosef Rodenberg, who was the Masada Gittin for many, many years, the Shev Refu Shleima in Baltimore. But does not mention Rav Schwartz's name, so I really want to point this out to Rav Sendrovic, who is also close to Rav Schwartz, that Rav Schwartz actually has a tshuva on this subject, so he also should be the Yehuda Ba'od Akra in terms of his name being mentioned as acquiescing with this spelling of San Diego. Yes.
What is the difference in the requirement for a geographic definition in a get versus a ketubah? Because we had a shaykh and I, many years ago, had the shaykh. We got married in a part of Toronto, a suburb that wasn't so clearly important. Is it Vaughan? Is it Woodbridge? And this was a shaykh. And I don't remember there being mention of any rivers.
The minhag in ksubos is generally to write the state, where you write the city and then you put a comma or something like we do that in Chicago, like Chicago, comma, Illinois. But it's not as essential because the document itself is not effectuating its change in status. It's just confirming that this particular man, wherever he happened to be, we don't really care where he got married, wherever he happened to be, he undertook this obligation that he's going to take care of this woman. But in the get, we need specificity in terms of this man in this particular location that we want to know that it has to be him. So we need all of these simanim of who he is and where he is, where he's standing, and all of these things, because the get is actually effectuating a change of status, of taking a woman out of the status of being an Eishes Ish to being a Grusha, who's a Mutaris Le'ama. So therefore, it is much more of a concern. And much more of an indispensable obligation to get it 100% precise. So when you're dealing with a get
in Israel, I did a chassidus where in the ksuba they do mention if it's by the water or by Yamagadol or what's it called, the other Kinneret, etc.
Yeah.
They mentioned it in the ksuba.
Yeah, but you don't have to. Meaning
no.
it's not as essential,
it's
right? Remember,
it's right.
And here,
right.
You know, again, it's a shtar kinyan.
It's a shtar kinyan.
Ksuba is a shtar raya with respect to just memorializing the obligation of the husband.
Other landmarks. I mean, you mentioned specifically bodies of water.
Right.
Like you mentioned Northbrook. You couldn't mention. In Northbrook, next to Sanders Road.
No. Bodies of water, which are considered to be very integral to the city, because you can't survive in a city without having a water source that nourishes the city, and it's also something that's going to be there over a very prolonged period of time. Sanders Road might not be there 20 years from now; it might be changed to some other.
What do they do in a landlocked city?
Yes.
Is that the right word?
A landlocked city becomes difficult. You might have to say hasmucha le. You say this city, which is next to that city,
right,
which happens to be next to the ocean.
Okay.
So I had some of these issues when I was looking into Northbrook. So I didn't want to have to go into all of that. But so we're still kind of assessing. That situation. I said let's just do it in Highland Park. Make it life a lot easier.
Can they say the name of a mountain or something?
No. It's supposed to be rivers. And this is all discussed in. These are good questions. This is all discussed in Evan Ezra Simon Kuf Kof Ches, explaining why it is that the rivers, because of the fact that they are integral, number one, in terms of being, they are landmarks, but they also actually are important support systems for the city. So the city really is defined in terms of its support systems of what keeps it going, what nourishes the people, what provides the water, the drinking water, and so forth for the people.
Water out of the Chicago River, odds are you're going to get sick and maybe die.
Right, which is why we don't have the Chicago River as a simon for Chicago. And we only have Lake Michigan as a simon for Chicago. So the second Shiloh that he deals with in this particular tshuva is having some sort of a memorial on the wall. It was on the wall of a shul, on the eastern side of the shul, so that the people who are davening are going to be facing in this direction. It's a memorial for victims of the Holocaust, and it's right near the Olam. So the concern would be that there are shitos, and this is discussed at great length. It's a Rishon by the name of Rabbeinu Eliyakim, who held that it wasn't right to have certain types of images that represented, like, the constellations in the sky. Maybe it would besmack a little bit, like in a Avodah Zarah, sort of a focus to have that on the wall of a shul, particularly in the direction that you're davening, to have lions and snakes and things of that variety. But he says, number one, and not everybody agrees with that, Rabbeinu Eliyakim, Beis Yosef disagrees with him. And number two, there he's talking about having pictures of, like, the Chayos, who might be constellation images, or might be like the images around the Merkava that stood for certain angelic figures and things of this that sort. But here, it's a picture of a Sefer Torah. It's like a Sefer Torah which is being illuminated through some sort of electricity that causes it to look like it's, you know, on fire, and fire in, like, you know, in a good way, that it's giving, you know, life to the Torah and memorializing the victims of the Holocaust, that they live on through the light and the illumination of the Torah. And he says, there's no surah. Right. There's nothing here that looks like it's sort of an image of a constellation that you're bowing down to, or the images of the Merkava, or something of that sort. So therefore, he says that you don't have that problem. I'm sorry, in terms of...
whatever you want to call them. Like, menorahs.
Right, if you have menorah.
The sixth tier
menorah, so you don't have a seventh tier menorah, which is itself
I'm talking about the Chalei Shoah.
Each week you have a six-prime menorah that reminds you of the Chalei Shoah. Right. So he says that it doesn't create these types of Avodah Zarah associations.
There are images of lions on parochos.
Ah, so that's the third thing that he says. And that was controversial, the images of the lions. But he says that the other concern was that it's going to be a bitul kavana, that you're looking at these beautiful images or whatever, so therefore it's going to be difficult for you to concentrate on your davening. So he says that where you do find that concern raised by the Darkei Moshe, but that was when you had lots and lots of very fancy pictures that would be in the Sidurim. Very, very interesting. In the Sidurim themselves, we know that in Haggadahs, they often have, like, fancy pictures in Haggadah, like the bird's eye Haggadah and things of that sort. But Haggadah might be a different story. We just want to keep people awake. But here, when you're davening, we don't want to do anything which is going to be a distraction of your kavana. So he says that would be if it was within the Siddur, but if it's just on the wall, so then he says, Logara, getting to Eddie's point, Logara Mimashi Vekama Bate Knesios Meshach Meo Shana, over the hundreds of years, Hamidu Arayas Allah and HaKodesh. They had lions on the earth, so you can have lions! So you certainly can have, like, an illuminated Sefer Torah. So he said that for sure. Like, so for these reasons, he thinks that that would be perfectly acceptable. And then the very end of the tshuva, I know that we already went through Yoredeya, but, you know, since you're allowed to attach to an Ibn Ezra, you know, Shaila, other things, so we already had, you know, one Yoredeya question about images, that's sort of a little bit Orachayim, a little bit Ibn Ezra, a little bit Yoredeya. So then he has another Yoredeya Shaila about whether you have an Orthodox shul, and they have a place in the cemetery that basically was meant for all of the members of the Orthodox community to be buried there. But there were Reform people who are, there's a Reform temple where they also wanted to purchase, like, a portion of the cemetery to bury their own dead. But it's going to be in its own separate standalone area. So Schwartz says, and this is a delicate kind of tshuva, so I'll try to say it over delicately. So Schwartz says that there are two advantages to having this. One is that it's in its own separate standalone place. And we know that the Gemara talks about that people who are in sort of like a higher level of Kedusha in terms of the observance in their life, and even talks about segregating different sinners, people who committed, you know, a lower level sin shouldn't be buried next to people who committed a higher level sin. So therefore, those who are not Shomer Shabbos, you are covering yourselves by putting them in sort of a separate part of the cemetery. If they want to be in the better part of the cemetery, very easy out. They can become Shomer Shabbos. So therefore, it's not, you know, discriminatory per se. And then the second thing that he says is it's really good to encourage them to have this all together, because even people who are sinners are also Jewish, and all Jews are supposed to be married in a Jewish cemetery, and therefore it's a good thing to accommodate those from the Reform community, that we should have that, let them have some sort of place in the Jewish cemetery. And this is, you know, a very positive thing, that they shouldn't, you know, go off and be buried in a non-Jewish cemetery or have, you know, cremation or, you know, God forbid,
or
something like that.
But are they all Jewish? Yeah. The
assuming that they're Jewish. He's working with the assumption that they are Jewish. Yes.
There's a yeshiva in New York City that has a zodiac on the floor as you enter one of its buildings.
Uh-huh. Yes, yes, I'm familiar with that, and maybe we can pick that up another time. So we're going to stop here. Next week, I think we're probably going to do Pesach and Yanim, because I've been asked as a special request to do the Yanim Pesach next week. And then we'll figure out if it makes sense to do the Monday night right before Pesach. We'll talk about that next week.